I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Robert Greenwald of Brave New Films about his latest documentary, Suppressed, The Fight to Vote, and with Linda Marshall, one of the voters whose story is told in the film. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land, The Stories That Divide Us, and Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. And the show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Quick plug for participation. These are organizations that can keep you involved in pushing a progressive agenda. And this year, of course, a lot of that has to do with electoral politics, which is the subject of today's show. But if you want to be involved on a daily basis, indivisible.us, indivisible.com, indivisible.org, I believe just about all the indivisibles, is a national organization with local groups, and you will get an email from them every week telling you actions to take that are relevant and timely. Two organizations that are digital but are working closely with grassroots on a national level, MoveOn.org, MoveOn1word.org, and in California, Courage Campaign, CourageCampaign1word.org. Two that are specific to communicating with your representatives, 5calls.org, that's the number 5 and the word C-A-L-L-S, 5calls.org. Tells you the relevant and timely calls you want to make to your representatives. And Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, tells you when your representatives are going to be at home holding meetings with constituents and you can go and see them face to face. Okay, so we certainly encourage you to participate and make this democracy work again. Now, to today's conversation, I assume that listeners to this show and all those who care about democracy are well aware of the challenges presented by gerrymandering, voter suppression, election manipulation, as well as the concerted efforts by Republicans to expand all of their negative impacts, at least since the Supreme Court's unprecedented 2001 decision in Bush v. Gore. The image that embodies those efforts to me is that of the 20th century reaching up out of the grave, grabbing the future of this country by the throat and proclaiming, not so fast. The Republican Party, its beliefs and its policies, while passionately held by millions, are no longer those of the majority of Americans, and so the only way they can survive and dominate, which they do at this moment, is to game the system. Their voters are more likely to vote, especially in non-presidential elections. They've strategically exploited that advantage to gerrymander electoral districts and pass laws to suppress voting, leaving us with Trump in the White House, GOP majorities in the Senate, the Supreme Court, and a majority of state legislatures and governorships. Today, we talk about one of those tactics, voter suppression. The new film, Suppressed, The Fight to Vote, produced by Brave New Films, exposes voter suppression tactics and policies used in Georgia in 2018 that could be deployed nationally in 2020 to disenfranchise voters. The issues Georgians faced included polling place closures, voter purges, missing absentee ballots, extreme wait times, and a host of voter ID issues, all of which disproportionately prevented many students and people of color from casting their ballots. Everything that many of us are fighting to achieve, immigration reform, ending mass incarceration, gun control, environmental justice, will only be possible if all Americans have equal access to vote. How far would you travel to vote if your local polling station was closed? How many phone calls would you make to make sure that you get to that you get your vote counted? How much time would you spend? How much effort would you go before giving up? Robert Greenwald, founder and president of Brave New Films, has produced and or directed more than 50 TV movies and miniseries. Documentaries produced by Brave New Films have been streamed across all 7 continents and have been viewed over 75 million times and counting. At Brave New Films, Greenwald has produced and directed Uncovered, The War in Iraq, Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism, Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers, Koch Brothers Exposed, War on Whistleblowers, and the latest, Suppressed, The Fight to Vote. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Linda Marshall. As I said, she is a retired university teacher who found that she did not get a chance to vote in Georgia in 2018, and we'll talk about her personal story in the second half of the show. So, Robert, welcome again to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, February 11th.
Good to be with you.
Yeah. And you know that I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So just a bit about how you made the transition from successful film and television director to Brave New Films.
I was working for a long time. I was working in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
It brought me to Los Angeles, where I was directing plays at the Mark Taper Forum. And then I made this switch over to commercial film and television, which I did for many years and enjoyed it and made tons of movies and miniseries and cable movies. And then right around 9/11, a couple of events coming together, obviously most profoundly 9/11 and then the death of my father and the forced reevaluation, and I realized that the best work I had done in the commercial world had often been based on real stories, number one. And number two, I really wanted, after 9/11, particularly in thinking of my four children, I very, very much wanted to be able to commit more time and energy to social justice and to making the world a better place. Highfalutin goals, but, you know, I am from New York, so we're taught to reach high. But I was fortunate enough, because I'd been successful in the commercial world, where I was able to make this change and basically become a full-time volunteer, started Brave New Films, and have been making full-length documentaries, as you mentioned. We just passed 9 or 10 million views on a series of short pieces. We've done around Donald Trump. We've done a whole series around mass incarceration. So we're using both short and long-form documentaries to tell stories. And then most importantly, I was so pleased to see you listing the organizations in the beginning, Terrence. Most importantly, with all our films, they are organizing tools. They are tools to take action. They're free, and people are screening them in bookstores and homes and churches and colleges and libraries with study guides, with reflection guides, and with an encouragement to take action. That's the most important thing, that people in seeing these films get involved, take action, and live up to that great line, democracy is not a spectator sport.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, one thing I want to touch on just before we jump into Suppressed, Robert, is a film that you made a few years ago that I interviewed you on, which was the one War on Whistleblowers. And the reason is just because, obviously, they've been in the news ever since one of them came forward about Trump's July 25th phone call with President of Ukraine Zelensky. And I know that this issue and these men and women are near and dear to you. You did that documentary, War on Whistleblowers, in 2013. And by the way, our interview for that one can be found at my site or at most anywhere you get this podcast. Any thoughts you have right now about whistleblowers and the White House whistleblower?
Well, I think that the importance of whistleblowers has quite obviously never been higher. It was extremely unfortunate, bad policy, and bad decision-making in the Obama White House, where whistleblowers were attacked, suppressed, and laws were used against them. We are seeing an escalation by far with this current administration. But the role they play, just think about how much we would not know about what is going on if it were not for whistleblowers combined with the press. Whistleblowers by themselves don't necessarily get an audience, but if you put whistleblowers and the press together, you're able to reach people, you're able to present truth to them, and you're able to expose the dark side, the very dark side, of what's going on with this administration.
And what we found in War on Whistleblowers, with the three whistleblowers that I interviewed that day who were featured in the film, is that although there are protections, they only go so far. Is that right? I mean, what happens to whistleblowers? What are they risking?
Well, The most profound risk is one that can't be characterized clearly around legislation. It's the risk to your livelihood. It's the risk to your reputation. It's the risk, particularly again with this administration, of being shamed. It's the risk of going to jail. Whistleblowers are an extraordinary group of people who decide they are going to pay the price,
yeah,
leaving the country. I mean, there are so many different iterations of what's happened to them, and we are deeply, deeply in their debt because they're the beginning of a process. You know, it may be the first piece of information, then it leads to more and more. So anything and everything we can do to protect them legally, legislatively, personally, they often are completely ostracized by their former friends and colleagues.
Mm-hmm. And so this one thing that kept coming up, and this will be the last question on whistleblowers, but one thing that kept coming up over the last, since that call was revealed, is people on the Trump side demanding that we name the whistleblower, that they have to come forward, that they have to testify and so on. A, why is this so misguided, and why is it so bad that Rand Paul is determined to identify that whistleblower to the public?
Well, the efforts to bring the whistleblower into the public sphere is truly disgusting, not a word that I often use. It's cowardice on the part of electeds who are trying to bring the whistleblower forward. The whole notion of whistleblower is you provide valuable, important, and critical information, and you're able to protect your identity in doing that. This idea that he or she have to be public is a complete creation of narrow, mean-spirited partisan politics.
Mm-hmm. And I would say anti-democratic. Okay, so we will leave that conversation.
Totally.
Yeah, we will leave that conversation on whistleblowers. But for those of you who have, you know, new to the term, new to watching what's been going on over the last couple of months, I recommend Brave New Films' documentary "War on Whistleblowers," 2013, during the Obama administration, which was, as Robert pointed out, very tough on whistleblowers. And you can also find the interview that I did with Robert and three whistleblowers, as I said, at my site and at Apple Podcasts and so on and so on. Okay, let's move to Suppressed. What led you to do this film at this time? And then you can even take it to and focus on Georgia.
It started by, like everyone, seeing some of the news reports out of Georgia. And I thought, wow, this is troubling if they're true. And I wasn't sure if they were true. I thought, well, maybe the press is overstating it, or maybe there were a couple of instances. So I started thinking, and this is the great value of being able to have an ongoing profit organization. We can start looking into something. We don't have to go out and beg and plead for a foundation grant. So we started looking into it, and I said, oh, yeah, this will make a strong 5-minute video aggregating what had been in the news and putting it all together. But the more we got into it, the more we heard about these truly democratic, heroic people like Linda, who I'm so happy is going to be on the program soon, telling their stories. And what did they want to do that was so horrible? They wanted to vote. I mean, can you imagine? And at times, literally, when we were doing the interviews and I was editing the material, I could not believe that it was this year we were having these issues around the people's right to vote, about the disgusting, awful racism that was in play to stop primarily people of color from voting. And the more we reached and the more interviews we did, the more people there were. I mean, people just kept coming forward and forward. And then we work with a lot of local groups, Stacey Abrams Group and the ACLU and others. And Georgia became the most immediate case study. It's not the only one, but it was a case study because they used so many different tactics. And that's when I felt, you know, this could be a film that could be helpful. Because as Carol Anderson says in the film, it's not, you know, one buddy in a Ku Klux Klan robe. It's a series of different efforts. You talked about it at the beginning. How long would you wait? Closing polling places, purging, voter ID. You know, it goes on and on. And what really got to me, there was one woman, and we were talking to her, and said, how long did you wait to vote? And she said, 4 hours. And I looked at myself and my colleagues. I don't think one of us would have waited 4 hours. And that's when I felt this was a story that we should tell, because one of the things we focus on at Brave New Films is telling the story of people who don't have the megaphone, who don't have the communication system, who aren't able to tell their stories to reach a larger audience. And so that began about a 9 or 10 month process of interviewing, editing, and again, being very clear, George is a case study, that this is national. It's concerted. It's legal for the most part, which makes it more troubling and more important that we shine a light on it and we get people involved in fighting voter suppression. Look, it's going to be how much money spent in this election, $1 billion, $2 billion, how much money spent on voter registration, how much money spent on get out the vote. But if the vote is suppressed, all of those efforts are going to be significantly minimized.
You put it in terms of money, but in terms of people's time, energy, passion, and belief. And the thing that happens, the more that this sort of voter suppression and gerrymandering and these other distortions of democracy, the more they happen, the more they create resignation and cynicism. And that works in the favor. It's almost a secondary form of voter suppression.
Yes, I think that's very well said. And distortions of democracy is true. And you have the sense that's prevalent in the society in general. Well, we can't do anything anyway. Well, if you begin to take away the vote, you begin to suppress the vote, it further increases that sense of we are being controlled by forces that we can impact. And democracy is founded on many principles, and one of them is voting. So to see it used so widely, to see it used in so many different forms, in so many different ways, and to find people, again, like Linda, who's going to be on soon, and many others who you'll see in the film, which, again, just to remind everyone, the film is free. It's at Brave New Films. You can get a link there. You can screen it at your home, your school, your church, your library, your bookstore, any bowling alley, any place that you can get people together or people are getting together. And then you have a discussion and talk about what actions can and should be taken. And there are a whole variety of actions, which you talked about in the beginning, some groups, Terrence, we have it on our website. So it's a call to everybody to do something.
Right. Not just to vote, but to fight, as the subtitle says, but to fight for the right to vote. One thing I will also mention is that for those who care about these issues, I did an interview a few months ago with Joshua Douglas, and he has a book that's about different actions successfully being taken in states around the country. Within the last month with Hedrick Smith on Democracy Rebellion, the PBS series, also about. So what we're talking about here is, A, there's bad news, but there is good news. And the good news is the people who are dedicated to taking this on. You look at the dysfunction in Washington, and what can we do about that? How can, you know, other than the election, what do we do? But the more local you get, whether it's your city, your state, your county, you can begin to really have power on some of these issues. Now, one of the things that you do in all, at least all of the documentaries I've seen from Brave New Worlds and from you, Robert Greenwald, is you don't just give us facts and data. You find characters with personal stories. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I appreciate that question. So film can do some things, not everything. Some things are better for a white paper. Some things are better for a book, for an investigative report. But what film can do, and what we go back to over and over and over again, no matter the subject, whether it's Drone Wars or the Koch brothers or Fox News or former gang folks, it puts a face on policy. It puts a human face on policy. And we spend a lot of time looking for those human faces, making sure they're comfortable on camera, making sure that they have a story that can work for a larger audience. You know, I go back to the Walmart film. I go back to when I flew to Pakistan and interviewed drone survivors, or flew around the country interviewing people who survived but had family or loved ones killed by guns. If you find those faces, and you let them tell their story, and then you connect the dots so that people know it's not individual, it is systemic. Again, you know, with the Walmart film, over and over again, I keep saying, this is not about a bad boss. It's about a system where capitalism run wild and what happens. With the suppressed film, over and over again, it was, well, there might be some cases where it was an accident and where it was incompetence, but if you look at the large picture and we find the different tactics used in different ways, we're able to have people like Linda and other wonderful people who you'll meet in the film, an 89-year-old man, they were trying to close his polling place because he wouldn't have been able to vote at all because he didn't have the money or the resources to go to a place further away. You get to meet those people, and you see and feel policy at a visceral level, and I do believe, and many of my friends disagree around this, that if you reach the heart first, then the mind will follow, rather than starting with the 10-point position paper and then trying to get the heart.
Absolutely. No, I'm very much in agreement, and it's that and it's interesting, actually, the more personal, the more individual the story, the more you make that connection, the more I think people can see the universality of the question or the issue or the problem. And it's one of those paradox of art, I think. Same thing happens in a play. The very specific things seem to illuminate universal issues. Let's talk about some of the methods that you cover in here through these personal stories. The disappearance of polling places.
Right. Well, that's, again, one of the things in the beginning that I felt maybe I was doing a story about a country that had a dictatorship that was trying to swing the elections and fake the elections, literally selectively closing polling places, primarily in districts, African-American students, lower income, where it was clear that by closing the polling places, they would reduce the number of people who vote. One of the experts calls it resource allocation. You decide where your resources go. A very bland term. But what that means is people are going to find it harder to vote by not having a polling station near them. And they would use the excuse, well, we're trying to save money. And our associate producer, Laurie, came up with this wonderful fact, wonderful and horrifying.
Yes.
Like one of the counties that was arguing they needed to close polling places to save money was spending more on the Christmas decorations than it would have cost for the polling place.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one thing, is they restrict polling places. And as you point out, they seem to restrict them. If you're filtering, you filter by two things. One, are they likely to vote against you? Are they more likely to be progressive, democratic, and so on? And two, are they more likely to be impacted by the closing of the polling place? You do it in a rich suburb, everybody's got a car or they can afford a Lyft driver, right? You do it where not only were they likely to not vote your way, but two, you're taking that ease away from, that convenience away, is actually going to work.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about registration, and that, it seems to me, is sort of the biggest one going on here. Voter registration and the purging of voter registration rolls. There's CrossCheck is one of the softwares that they use. But talk to us a little bit about how widespread and how powerful this is.
The original notion of well, I don't know if it was original. One of the original notions of purging was sort of this notion of cleaning up the voter rolls. You know, people die, people move away, legitimate things happen where you don't necessarily want those people on the voting rolls. What the some of the conservatives, right-wingers, and Republicans have done is they're turning purging into an art form of a precision weapon that takes out significant numbers of potentially Democratic voters. And it does it by knowing that, you know, certain areas there's a higher turnover rate. People, lower income people, tend to move more. And they have, in Georgia and around the country, have purged an incredible number of people. And there's no indication that those people were voters who, in fact, had either died or moved in a different district. What happens if you don't vote in one election or two elections? Is that a reason to be have your name taken off? And the other really malicious thing about purging, and again, the good news is, and I want to make sure that we stress this, as you did, Terrence, the good news is there are organizations. They're fighting back. They're having effect. There's legislation being passed. There are lawsuits. And if you go to our website or to Terrence's, you can find out about these organizations. So, you know, we're definitely fighting back and winning some of these battles. But you show up at election day, you don't know that you've been purged. Maybe they sent you a postcard. Maybe you didn't notice it. Maybe it got tossed in the mail. And suddenly you're there on election day and you can't vote. And your options are very limited at that point.
Yeah, I know one of the options in Georgia, and see, tell me if I've got this right, because when I heard it, it sounded, they can't possibly mean that, was that if you showed up and you knew you were rightfully should be able to vote, but they'd purged you and you couldn't vote, what you could get was a provisional ballot. And you fill it out and it's a provisional ballot. But if I'm not mistaken, in Georgia, you had to show up somewhere, some government building, within 3 days of that vote with something that further proved your identity. Now, if you're a working person, if you're, you know, if you've got a tight schedule, if you're a single mom, that is probably enough to erase your vote.
Yes. I mean, it's absolutely true. And we have a story in the film of somebody trying to put all the information together and go to the government building and make sure their provisional ballot is being cast. But again, let's think about this from a practical human point of view. How much hours?
Yep.
How much time? How much effort? How much money are you willing to lose if you're in a job where they're not going to give you
That's right.
the day off or the second day off to go down and deal with the provisional ballot? It's a pure form of economic prejudice and bias, in addition to what it's doing to the voters and as the young people in the film. There's some wonderful students. Now, they talk about the deep emotional pain of going to vote for the first time. And as one young lady says, why is it this hard? Mm. Why don't they want me to vote?
Yeah. And one thing I would say is that you pointed it out that as with gerrymandering, purging, computer technology and powerful algorithms has made this much more dastardly, if you will. I mean, the precision with which you can now either set a district, which is what they did in 2010, or undertake a purge is, you know, really, I mean, it's amazing, but it's frightening and horrible.
Yes, absolutely. And, that Republican operative who died, I think, last year, and
right.
his daughter has released a lot of his
yes.
data and information. I mean, it's, yes, the machines and the machinery and the ability to figure this out is at a level that we really aren't sufficiently dealing with. And again, I don't want to just say the sky is falling. I want to say this is a call to do something. Things can be done. Lawsuits, even though we're having challenges in the judicial system with many of these judges, there are lawsuits that are successful, and there are elections.
Right. And we're going to let you go in just a second, Robert, and bring in Linda Marshall. But I wanted to say that finally, it's give your pitch for, again, for seeing the film, showing the film, using the film. And then one thing that I love is, if I'm not mistaken, the last minute or two or three is a recitation, one after another, of successful actions taken in different communities to give felons back the right to vote, to clean up purges, to open more polling places, to do that. There is a movement and a lot of action being taken right now to be successful. So, sort of your last pitch for why what people can do with the film Suppressed.
Well, I would say part of the thing that I love about working in Brave New Films, running Brave New Films, coming here, is that I don't want to just be angry and pissed off at the TV or radio or newspaper or my computer. I want to be able to do something. And the films, this one most recently, are a tool to let every single person in the audience do something. And the do something can be organizing a free screening. As I say, it can be in your home, have three people. It can be at a local club. It can be any place people gather together or where you want people to gather. It's much easier to get people to come see a film, frankly, than it is to have them hear a speaker,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they can use the film themselves. So if you want to be involved, if you want to take action, or if you don't want to do a screening, you can go to Facebook, you can go to Twitter, you can pass clips around, you can go to my Twitter feed, you can go to Brave New Films and send them along. There's a significant amount of research now about how impactful social media is if it's what they call trusted messenger. You sending to your aunt and uncle is more effective than some big company, you know, pumping ads at them. So I would say that it's there. It's for people who say, yes, I'm upset. Yes, I'm concerned. Yes, I want to do something. And here is something you can do. And you're going to hear right now from Linda Marshall, who has a story that will further inspire you to do something.
Okay. And the other thing is, on the site of bravenewfilms.org, are the resources as well, Black Voters Matter Fund, Election Protection, Reclaim Our Vote, Rock the Vote, Swing Left, Vote Riders. You can find the organizations that can help you and your friends around the country take this issue into their own hands and actually take that anger, that frustration, and so on, and channel it to do good. Thank you very much, Robert Greenwald. As always, keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. And thank you, Linda, for joining. Bye
right.
all.
Right. And now Bye. We will be joined by Linda Marshall. And Linda is a retired university professor who formerly taught government and recently moved to Georgia from Virginia. She registered to vote months before the deadline. Her name did not appear on the poll list. She asked for a provisional ballot. Poll worker refused to give it to her. She wasn't able to vote. That's the quick story. Linda, I want you to share this in a really personal way, sort of like, what has voting meant to you in your lifetime? What had been your experience up to the 2018 midterm? And then the sort of the details of the frustration, so that we can, as we Robert and I talked about earlier, put a person. It's radio, so a podcast, not a face, but a voice, a person, and a personal story to bring all of this home. So, Linda Marshall, your experience over the years with voting and participation.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for giving me an opportunity to be involved in this discussion, and also another opportunity to hear Robert every time I hear him speak and talk about his work. I'm continually inspired. So I thank you both for that. Now, my experience in voting has been very much participating myself and getting everybody else to participate that I could come in contact with. For several years, I taught government to high school seniors, which was at that pivotal point where they were learning about the American system, our democratic republic, and also at the same time being able to cast their votes for the first time in their lives. That was very, very rewarding. Now, personally, I have lived up and down the East Coast from Boston to Florida for educational things and jobs and other kinds of things. And I have lived in states that supposedly have issues with voter suppression, such as Virginia, such as Florida, such as Maryland, all of these states. But when I got to Georgia in 2018, I'm a new Georgia resident. I had just finished seminary up in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and came down here to begin sort of my second act in terms of my career. And I ran very hard into an invisible structure, and it is a structure, and a well-thought-out structure, and a very bureaucratic system of public policy to discourage people to vote.
I just wanted to remind people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. We spoke earlier with Robert Greenwald, founder and lead director at Brave New Films, about their latest documentary, Suppress, The Fight to Vote. You can learn more at bravenewfilms.org. And now have the privilege of speaking with Linda Marshall, who is one of the stories, one of the people that we see in Suppressed, and her experience with, as she says, a structure designed and intended to keep her and people like her from voting. So you moved to Georgia, and you assume things are going to be as they always were. When do you first notice you have a problem?
I first noticed that I have a problem when it's about 2 weeks before the election. And I have sent in all kinds of documentation to the Secretary of State's office so that I can be registered to vote. I did not get anything in my mail. Honestly, to tell you the truth, my application to the Secretary of State's office has never been acknowledged. And the only way that I am now a registered voter is because I click that little paragraph when I was getting my license switched from Virginia to Georgia. And I heard from them through that system, but I put my application in August of 2018, and I did not get a registration card until April of 2019.
Wow. So that's one thing I was going to ask, was how early did you start this process? So in August, the election's coming up in November, in August,
right,
you made an application and sent it by snail mail?
Actually, I took it down to the post office by snail mail to be delivered to the Secretary of State's office.
Okay.
So then their process is to ferret those different registration forms out to the various counties where people live.
And you're in Fulton County, which is the county of Atlanta, Georgia, right?
Yes, it is. And I am another reason I'm very convinced about the structure is because there is no way that they could know that I was an African-American woman, but they could look at the county that I live in, and Fulton County has been Democratic for decades.
In the state of, so, in the state of Georgia, that while it was Democratic up until the Civil Rights era, became strongly Republican after that, with Fulton and, my guess is, Athens and maybe a couple of other
Democratic strongholds.
Strongholds within.
That's exactly right.
Right. And so you're saying that just when they say, oh, new resident to Fulton, there's a chance they're a Democrat.
Well, that's very true, because like I said, there was no way that they could know, because if they looked at my address, they would think probably that I was a white woman, because I live in the Buckhead section of Atlanta, which is a rather affluent.
Right. Section. Let me just share with you, when you were saying you'd lived various places up and down the coast from Boston to Florida, I have lived, before I moved to California, half of my life in Florida and half in Boston. And my family lives in Atlanta. So I'm quite familiar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, as you say, Buckhead is not a poor area, but it is Fulton County. So
yes, it is.
2 weeks before you sent everything. It's now been, so we're talking, it's now late October. So it's been a couple of months and you've received nothing back, and you're starting to what? Get on the phone, go online.
Yes, I'm calling the Secretary of State's office. I'm calling the Fulton County Board of Elections. I even called other counties nearby Fulton, thinking that it may have been misdirected by the Secretary of State's office. And I am finally told, you're nowhere to be found. The only thing I can suggest you do is show up at your polling place and request a provisional ballot.
Is the fact that it's.
My experience covers two things, registration and provisional ballot.
Right, right. Is the fact that it's 2 weeks before the election why you can't just register then? Is that why they have to leap to the provisional ballot?
Well, I can only follow what the Secretary of State said to me, which was, it's too late now.
Mm-hmm. So too late.
They offered me, it would seem to me, they would have offered me an opportunity to register immediately, but that was not offered.
That was not offered. Okay.
What was offered to me was to go to my polling place and request a provisional ballot, which, as you discussed with Robert, has a provision that you have to show up several days later to confirm that you are who you are. So the provisional ballot was not necessarily the answer to the question.
Right.
It was just kind of a stop, a stop and hold to see if I would actually be able to vote.
And so did you go through that procedure? Did you, on Election Day, go down to the polling place and request a provisional ballot?
I certainly did.
And
that's when the feathers started flying.
Because?
From the bird. I went. I told them that I was not on the roll. I had my passport. I had my mortgage lease and all of that. I had everything that I was supposed to have. And when I requested the provisional ballot, one of the poll workers just said, you need to go talk to him. Him was Mr. King, who was the supervisor there in the polling place. He had had one of the Georgia statutes on the desk that said, if your name is not on the roll, you may not get a ballot. I had another statute that was specific to provisional ballots that was created just for the situation that I was in, he would not have it. He would not hear anything about that. And then I said, I need to speak to your supervisor because this statute tells me that I am eligible for a provisional ballot, and I'll live to fight that a couple of days later, but right now I want a ballot.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you may not have a ballot. I said, sir, my statute is specific to my situation. But anyway, I said, I need a supervisor's number. He gave me a number, but he made me go outside. It was pouring rain.
Of course.
Rain was just coming down from everywhere. So I go outside to call the number. The number is out of service.
He gave you a number that was out of service.
So I go, yeah. Yes, he gave me a number that did not work 3 times.
Okay.
I had to go back a second time and say, sir, this number does not work. He gave me another number. I went outside in the rain to call that. That was also a disconnected number. So I go back in a third time, and I said, look, I'm tired of this. You need to give me a number that works. Because he had said to me earlier, if you get in touch with a supervisor and they instruct me to give you a provisional ballot, I will do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm getting these numbers from him that do not work. Finally, I get a number that does work at the Fulton County Board of Elections, and they tell me the same thing that he told me. That I could not have a ballot because I was not on the rolls. And I said, well, what do you think the purpose of a provisional ballot is? It's to settle these issues, to allow people to vote. That's the law that's on the books. But I couldn't get one.
Wow. So you had gone to, research this with the Secretary of State's office. They'd told you what would work. They'd given you, I assume, that that information that you were using, you know, to say, look, I'm supposed to be able to get a provisional ballot. And yet the poll worker, the lead poll worker, and the lead poll worker's supervisor all misinterpreted the law and refused to give you a ballot.
They were totally unaware. Totally untrained, totally dismissive. The third time that I went in there, he looked at me like, it's you again?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going, I want to vote today.
Yeah.
I have everything that I'm supposed to have to be able to vote, and the least that you can do is make a provisional ballot available to me.
Right. With the evidence you'd showed them, as you said, you had your driver's license, you had your mortgage papers. They knew you lived where you said you lived, and they still would
That's
not give
exactly
you.
Right.
And so they never did give you a provisional ballot, and there wasn't time at that point for you to get to the Secretary of State's office, or you didn't have time, or you know what I'm saying? It's like, it seems like...
Well, I told the lead poll director, I said, look, see this email right here from the, I think it was the deputy director of elections.
For the state of Georgia.
Secretary of State's office.
Yeah.
I say, see this email right here telling me to come and get a provisional ballot. He looked at me and he said, I don't want to see anything on your phone. It's probably fraudulent.
Whoa. Wow.
So, I mean, we were going back and forth and back and forth. And finally, I said, I'm not going to get anywhere with him, particularly since I cannot get anybody at the Fulton County Board of Elections to call him and instruct him to give me a provisional ballot. So I left.
Mm-hmm.
And I left there furious. I'm still kind of furious about it. When I Yeah. Think about
it. I know. We're bringing it up here.
And you now
realize once you've had your experience, you now realize a few things, I'm imagining. One, that you're not the only one this is happening to. And two, that Stacey Abrams has a real shot at being governor. And if what's happening to you is happening to another few thousand of you, she might not get that chance.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what I said in the film. This was an historic election of just huge proportion. And it was just very, very clear. And seeing the film that Brave New Films produced regarding this, The Suppressed, just made it even more clear to me that there was and there is a system. It's a very strong system. It's a very well thought out system. And it is very much public policy in the state of Georgia. And it is not designed for people to engage that system very well. If there's any discrepancy of any kind, spelling of your name, polling place closes, lack of registration. Like I said, I still have not heard from the Secretary of State regarding my application or from Fulton County. The only way I have a registration is because I bought a new car.
Yep.
And I had to go to the DMV to register it.
And the DMV,
I clicked that little box.
And the DMV in Georgia
allows
you to register as a voter when you transact business with the DMV.
Yes, there is a question on the application. Do you want to be registered to vote?
Yeah. Well, that's a good
and
thing.
I said, yes.
So what has happened?
That's a good thing.
Definitely. So let me just ask you to close here and sort of what's happened for you since then, besides showing up in this film, what's happened to you, a former teacher of civics who was deprived of the right to vote in 2018? What have you taken on besides appearing on this film? And what would you say to listeners?
Well, there are two levels that you can work on. Because of my involvement, I'm a three-time federal appointee in both Republican and Democratic administrations. So I think about this thing from a policy point of view. There are things that you can do on that level. There are very specific things that you can do, like taking people to the polls, that kind of thing. So it depends upon where you're trying to make your impact. I have chosen to be part of a lawsuit, that has been put forth by, I think, spearheaded by fairfightaction.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can get in touch with them. They are really doing some marvelous things here in the state of Georgia. That's Stacey Abrams Group, fairfightaction.com.
And fairfightproject.org
is also very involved in fighting against voter suppression, as is Common Cause of Georgia.org.
Mm-hmm.
So those are what I would recommend. This is not a fight that can be done individually, because it is, as I keep saying, it's
a system
that has been very well built to keep the current people in power, because it's really a matter of the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
If you project out to 2024, this country is going to be flipping in terms of who is the majority and the minority. And people have known this for a very long time. And I think what I ran into, that wall that I ran into in Georgia, was a response to the demographic shift that is going on all over our nation. It's already happened in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think California is one of the states that leads the country in that. California is already a minority majority state.
But do you have the kinds of structural impediments to voting that exist here in Georgia? See, I think Georgia is round one of what's been going on, and it's been going on for a number of years. So much so that what appears to be disconnected is actually very coordinated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And remember, for people who don't recall, the Secretary of State of Georgia was Stacey Abrams' opponent in that election, running for governor. Running for governor while overseeing the electoral process and all of these purges and so on. And that has happened elsewhere. If you remember, Patricia Harris was the chair of Bush's campaign in Florida in 2000. She was also chair of the Republican Party there. Blackwell in Ohio, when Kerry lost Ohio in 2004.
Right.
The Secretary of State was also a candidate and the chair of the Republican campaign. We've got to bring this to a close, Linda Marshall, but thank you for sharing your personal story and your personal... I mean, it's interesting. What I hear from you is both a conviction that grew over time that this was a different enemy, a different ordeal than at first you thought, and that it's one that we must all take very seriously and get involved on. Thank you very much, Linda Marshall,
for
your time.
That's exactly right. Thank you very much.
Okay. So again, the documentary is Suppressed, The Fight to Vote. The website is bravenewfilms.org. Some of the organizations which you will find there and which you can find if you are looking for voter protection, she mentioned Fair Fight. Fair Fight is building voter protection teams in 20 key states across the country. Reclaim Our Vote, nonpartisan phone bank, which you can volunteer for to help people in overcome voter suppression. Sister District. That's interesting, where it works to turn states blue by winning state legislative elections, and you can work with them. Swing Left. Vote Riders is an organization, national, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization started by a friend of mine, Kathy Unger. And what it does is, in those states that have instituted voter IDs, it provides free information and all sorts of help for people so that they can make sure that they can get the right kind of voter ID, which is a challenge for students and seniors sometimes to vote in their local election. So there's lots of ways to get involved. As I said, you can look at the bravenewfilms.org website. You can also look back at some of my recent shows with Lawrence Lessig on They Don't Represent Us, with Hedrick Smith on the Democracy Rebellion, with Joshua Douglas on the reforms that are taking place at states all around the country. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. That's terrencemcnally.net or A World That Just Might Work, all one word. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 links to 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my website, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on Apple Podcasts and most other major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at Apple Podcasts and all those other sites. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell and Teddy Robinson in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And thank you to our earlier guest, Robert Greenwald, and to you, Linda Marshall. Keep up the good work.